This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. From the team that brought you the world's greatest laugh.
Robbie.
And the world's wheeziest laugh. It's Behind the Scenes on your radio now.
We're going Movieville this week and I'm excited.
You know what? This is one of those films that I would have never thought we'd cover because it's the type that none of us have seen it. I don't even have to ask you guys to know that you haven't seen this film. It is an old classic, perhaps better known for the production and what went wrong rather than for what you actually saw on the silver screen.
Elizabeth Taylor as Cleopatra, Siren of the Nile. Her stunning beauty and notorious intrigue turned the tide of civilization.
In attaining her objectives, Cleopatra has been known to employ torture, poison, and even her own sexual talents, which are said to be considerable.
Interesting, sort of.
I love how
what a way
when Sonal does behind the scenes, we always get some historical kind of nuanced story. When I do behind the scenes, we get Arnold Schwarzenegger's 1984 bow as man, half robot.
Oh, no, trust me. This story is as salacious as they come. Chris,
you know
you're going to love this one.
I was looking at Black Swan and Natalie Portman, then I didn't realize there was another feature underneath this. So it's all things Cleopatra.
It is. So the film came out in 1963, and the film was so lavish, so ambitious, that it almost ruined one of the biggest production studios, 20th Century Fox. Now, Cleopatra eventually cost $44 million. This was back in the 60s.
Oh, wow.
It had two directors, two different casts, four locations, and took 2.5 years to complete.
You know what I'm thinking? Have you seen the movie?
I haven't, no.
Rob?
And I never will.
Do you really need to ask that question?
Yeah,
of course I've seen it. I've watched it many times. It's one of my favorite. No,
I've never seen it either.
I don't think we're missing anything, to be honest, from the little clips that I've seen. But it was an incredible behind-the-scenes story because, in the words of the director, the second director and final director, Joseph Mankiewicz, it was conceived in a state of emergency, shot in confusion, and wound up in a blind panic.
Yeah,
this is the very director of the film. He was interviewed at the premiere, in fact, by a red carpet reporter who, you know, being of a jovial nature, said, a wonderful, wonderful achievement. And Mankiewicz said, well, you must know something I don't.
The director is saying that.
Yeah.
You know you're doomed.
Yeah, the reporter says, is some of the tension gone? Do you feel more at ease? He says, no, I feel as though the guillotine were about to drop. Is that the premiere of the film?
The director is over it. At this point, the director's like, what have I done?
Get me on to my next project.
Career suicide right here. I am done with this.
Now,
thing.
If you thought The Irishman was bad at clocking in at 3 hours, guess how long this one is?
Oh, my Lord. Cleopatra is going to be 3:40.
4 hour. A four-hour notorious train wreck.
4 hours? That's. I could almost do the Spinnies to my 92 cycle challenge and get back for the end credits.
Just watch it on your little phone as you
were
going.
That's insane for a 1960s movie to be 4 hours in length.
Yeah, and Elizabeth Taylor wasn't even at the premiere, but she did reluctantly host a screening of the film, apparently, according to how the story goes.
And she was the star, right?
She was the star of the film, immediately rushed back to her Dorchester hotel room and threw up after seeing it.
What?
Wow.
That's got to be myth.
So the film was outrageously, outrageously over budget. There was a massive scandal taking place behind the scenes, specifically the adulterous affair between the stars Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. They, of course, you know, their love story is well told, but this is essentially where it all started. This was the inception of it. And it's really hard to imagine how far-reaching this story got. When they were having their affair, it was bumping John Glenn orbiting the Earth off the front pages. They were officially denounced in the U.S. Senate.
What?
And the Vatican weighed in with their own judgment on the matter.
I did not realize it went that high.
It was the scandal of all scandals. We're actually going to have to go back in time a little bit for the backstory here, all the way back down to 1958, okay? 5 years prior, before the movie actually was released and came out, you've got a different affair that Elizabeth Taylor is embroiled in. Now, initially, she's a grieving widow, and this is following the death of her third husband, Mike Todd. He was tragically in a plane crash. They'd been married for less than a year, and she was absolutely devastated. At their wedding was best man Eddie Fisher, maid of honor Debbie Reynolds. Debbie Reynolds, famous for Singing in the Rain. Don't know if you've seen that. Yeah. So she was the star of that. And they were there to celebrate their union. And let's hear what happened next from Barbara Walters.
When Elizabeth flew to Chicago for the funeral, she was accompanied by Todd's best friend, singer Eddie Fisher. His wife, Debbie Reynolds, stayed in Los Angeles to watch over Elizabeth's three small children. 5 months later, Elizabeth and Eddie Fisher were romantically linked. They tied the knot in Las Vegas on the same day he divorced America's sweetheart, Debbie Reynolds.
What have I just listened to?
Oh, my God.
They were best friends.
That's brutal.
No, forget that. Debbie's looking after Elizabeth's kids.
Yep. Well, I mean, they were the best of friends. Debbie and Elizabeth are best friends. Eddie and Mike are best friends. You know, they were at their wedding. They were there for her when she lost Mike. And then, of course, as she was grieving, Eddie and her just kind of, you know, sparks happened.
Jeepers.
She's not been grieving that hard, with all respect.
Exactly.
I mean, that was a short grief period.
Yeah, and poor Debbie. Debbie, who's left behind. Eddie leaves, of course, and leaves Debbie with their two toddlers, one of them who turns out to be Princess Leia herself, Carrie Fisher.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So Eddie and Debbie's daughter was Carrie Fisher of Star Wars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the whole scandal had this real air of it of, do you remember when Brad Pitt left
Jennifer Aniston?
For Angelina Jolie. It was very much like, oh, he left the good girl for the vixen. It was that kind of story that was told. It was very similar in the tabloids. It was Eddie leaving the good girl for the bad girl. You know, she had a really bad reputation around that time. This personal drama is all unfolding in the tabloids when this happens.
The occasion, the Hollywood signing of the exotic Elizabeth for the most exotic role in her career. And the role Cleopatra, the most fascinating woman of history.
Now, this was record-breaking stuff because Taylor signed on for a contract of $1 million. This is 1959 to star in Cleopatra. She explains how it happened.
I was in the bathtub and I yelled a figure out through the door for $1 million and 10% of the gross. And they came back and said, okay. And I just let out a yell. And sort of went under the water screaming. That's how the first $1 million in films was made. It was a joke.
No actor had ever been paid that sum before. She was the first, the very first, male or female, to be paid $1 million for a role. And it was because she was kind of joking about it.
The first million pound footballer?
I was going to ask the same thing.
It wasn't Cantona, was it?
No, it wasn't. Trevor Francis.
Elizabeth Taylor was the Trevor Francis of Hollywood. Don't think she'd appreciate that analogy.
I don't know. Maybe she would, though.
Oh,
maybe she
great.
Would.
I'm so good.
She said, if someone's dumb enough to offer me $1 million to make a picture, I'm certainly not dumb enough to turn it down. And then it was all systems go for a while from there. The director signed on. A guy called Peter Finch is in as Caesar. Stephen Boyd is going to play Mark Antony. There's this. The first issue that they face, though, is that there's a subsidy from the British government. And initially, they tried to set the film in London instead of a more suitable location that could mirror Egypt's sort of sun-drenched, you know, climate. They end up in London. So work begins on about $600,000. Remember, this is the 60s. It's a whole different meaning when we say $1 million, $600,000. They're covering 20 acres. They're importing palm trees. They got 52 feet high sphinxes. All the while, the British weather is just bringing all their plans down. It's just not letting anything stay where it needs to be. And the issues present right off the bat. First day of shooting, they've got two work stoppages. It's because the British hairdressers took issue with the fact that Elizabeth had imported her own American stylist.
Oh, come on.
They're offended. Then by the third day, Liz calls in sick. She takes to her hotel room for weeks. She's diagnosed with a virus, an abscess tooth, some sort of bacterial disease called Malta fever. So she is out of commission for weeks on this set that she's got paid $1 million to do.
She's just at it.
So production comes to a halt. The director, the first director, resigns. This is after $7 million of expenditure.
Wow.
And at the end of it, Fox has about 10 minutes of footage for that $7 million. None of it includes Elizabeth Taylor. That's just the start of it all. Plans are recalibrated. For some reason, they didn't shelve this. They recalibrate. They bring in a new director. He's acclaimed, renowned director, Joe Mankiewicz. He's now at the helm. And the thing is, before he can get going, so they're about to restart. Everything's about to come back online. Once again, in March 1961, Taylor is rushed to a London hospital with a lung congestion. It was so serious, she had a tracheotomy. You know, when they kind of cut you open so you can breathe properly? And you can see the scar in the movie. So for days, she was in ICU, basically. She was in a coma for a part of it. Eventually, she began to rally. They started to print her obituary already. Yeah, she was announced as dead in certain situations already. But after a few days, her physicians announced she's made a very rare recovery.
Back in the United States after her brush with death in London, Elizabeth Taylor is carried from her plane in a wheelchair. The arrival at New York of the actress, who was in England to play the title role in Cleopatra, is graphically filmed. She takes the excitement like the true trooper she is, though she's still weak from her bout with an exceptionally virulent form of pneumonia. And now, representing a triumph for the will to live, she's off to California for a long rest in which fully to recuperate.
From homewrecker to triumphant survivor.
Yeah, well, there you go, yeah.
That's all it took, almost dying. Yeah. And all of a sudden, she's America's hero
once
again.
She's got a few more husbands in her yet.
Exactly. But also, you note there by the end, he said a couple of months rest in California. So once again, everything's put on hold. By now, it's 1961. Okay, so it's been years already that this has been stalled. Now, her period of recovery that she was taking from her second bout of serious illness, where she almost died, actually created some time for the new director to figure out how to go ahead, because he had this nonsense footage that he was left behind with from the previous director. He made no sense for this to be set in London, so he moves the production to Italy, rewrites the script entirely, recasts the entire film. He's starting from scratch. So all of a sudden, you've got new male leads as well. They're keeping on Elizabeth Taylor, but they're moving in Rex Harrison and Richard Burton. Richard Burton, we will come to, of course. Now, you've been absent from this film. You've caused a whole lot of heartbreak for the studio. I mean, how do you return when you do make your return and you arrive in Italy?
Sheepishly.
Oh, well, not if you're Elizabeth Taylor, let me tell you. She arrives in Italy with an entourage, including her husband, three children, five dogs, two cats, secretaries, dozens of servants, and moves into a 14-room mansion known as Villa Papa.
I love it.
So at this point, the clock is ticking. I mean, the costs are really building up by the day. So the director, the new director, Menkowitz, is filming by day and rewriting the script by night. He had so many health issues by the end of this film. He was taking daily injections and could hardly walk by the end of it. He was working so hard. Now, in Italy, they couldn't find the facilities to process the kind of film that they were using. So it was actually sent back to Hollywood to be processed, then brought back to Rome for review. I mean, the excess in all of the costs that were used, it was insane when you look at the bills.
Someone at this point is going, this is all too much. We got to just axe this.
Apparently, there were about 50 chauffeurs and 50 drivers on set. And they said, OK, well, we got to get rid of a few. And then one of the actors complained, so they reinstated it. One of the other things that they didn't foresee is a beach that they were using where they were making a massive replica of Alexandria. It's called Torre Astura was the area. Turned out it was laced with mines left over from World War II. So all of a sudden it's costing them $22,000 to do mine dredging so that they could go ahead and proceed with that. On top of that, the set was adjacent to a NATO firing range. So as a producer said, we'll have to arrange our schedule so we're not working when the big guns are blasting. Literally. So there's all these obstacles as they're trying to go ahead with the production. And of course, chief among them now is we come to Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who didn't begin working together until January 1962 as Cleopatra and Mark Antony.
You will kneel.
I will what?
On your knees.
You dare ask the proconsul of the Roman Empire?
I asked it of Julius Caesar. I demand it of you.
She does not come across as a great actress there, to be fair.
Is she still with Eddie Fisher at this point?
Yeah, yes. Eddie Fisher's in Italy.
She is.
With the three kids.
She's still married. Richard Burton is married to a woman by the name of Sybil Burton.
Right.
And now, before they had met, Elizabeth Taylor thought he had a renowned theater stage career, which, you know, in those days, that was you were an esteemed actor. That was the highbrow stuff. She was worried that he would look down on her for her lack of theatrical training. But apparently he showed up on his first day incredibly hungover and barely functioning. So in their first scene, sparks were flying once again.
Lordy.
I get the feeling that sparks flew a lot when Elizabeth Taylor
yeah, I think that might
in fact
be the case. She's
quite a sparky individual.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. It turned out, despite the fact that her husband number four, Eddie Fisher, was milling around the set, Richard, as we said, was married himself. He was a known womanizer, but it was that kind of womanizer back then of, you know, oh, he always returns to Sybil.
Yeah.
He does what he needs to do, but he always goes back to Sybil. People
like
assumed.
A boomerang.
Yeah.
Like a boomerang. Oh, there's Richard Burton.
A boomerang that's caught a few things on the way back around.
Yeah, boomerang Burton.
It didn't take long until this torrid affair is the talk of Rome and then eventually the world. So much so that, you know, at one point, this story goes that when they were filming a love scene, they seemed to have forgotten they were on set.
What?
And a publicist of the film, John Brodsky, remembers.
It ended and Joe Mankiewicz said, cut. And he said, cut. And then he finally had to go, cut. And then they got up and everybody, of course, laughed. And, you know, everybody knew by then what was going on.
It was moving into a movie genre that we'd not...
we haven't touched upon.
Exactly.
If you'll pardon the pun.
Yeah.
The thing is this affair was passionate. It was explosive. It was on and off. It was not conducive to... you know, structured film schedule. They drank a lot. They turned up late. Sometimes they didn't turn up at all. They
fought
frequently.
What was Eddie doing at this point?
Yeah, Eddie was upset. I mean, I can't even get into all the lurid details of this story because it's actually just too much.
But Eddie had been brought as part of the entourage. Was he summarily dismissed or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, well, he was upset. He kind of came to find out what was happening. Him and Sybil talked about it. At one point, he goes away. He's trying to have a run-in with Richard. I mean, there's a whole commotion happening with Eddie behind the scenes as well.
Eddie.
Yeah.
To be fair, Eddie kind of knew what he was getting into, didn't he?
You think.
Essentially, you know, helped a grieving widow in her hour of need.
Yeah. I still think he was pretty upset by it. By all accounts, he was very upset about the whole thing. All the while, the production moves to Egypt from Italy to film these battle sequences. Now, Joe Mankiewicz hates these scenes and secures another $2 million to reshoot them in Spain instead. Because, you know, that first set of battle scenes wasn't enough. Let's just do a whole nother set of the same ones so that they're better.
You're the director.
Yeah.
If they're tenable, it's because of you. Right. I mean, he's the blooming man responsible for making those battle scenes good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the costs were absurd. In addition to that, there was sort of tens of thousands spent on paper cups. It was one of those things, apparently, where people knew that they could just write off whatever they needed. So if they needed something for the house, they could just kind of throw it on the bill somehow. There was a lot of that going on as well. Anyways, at some point now, the studio has had enough. They're like, this film needs to come to an end. So this is, you know, they just set a date. Elizabeth's last day of filming needs
to be
June 23rd.
Sounds like one of the essays I wrote at uni. This damn essay needs to be finished. I'm just going to set next Monday.
Stop.
And it's going to be submitted, regardless of what sort of state it's in.
Exactly. They had been filming for 272 days in Rome. It had been 632 days since they had started in London. The intense schedule took a toll on people. Back in L.A., Joe Mankiewicz is starting to prepare a rough cut of the film, which is now 5 hours and 20 minutes. So he says, okay, I think this has to be two parts. The studio says, no, thank you. We need this to be one film because we need to capitalize on what's going on, this public fascination with Taylor and Burton. So all of a sudden, now they have to have one film. They fire Mankiewicz, but nobody else knows how this story fits together with all this random footage they've got.
Why do they fire him?
Well, because he wants to have two films and they want one.
Okay,
part one, part two.
And no one else knows what to do with all this ridiculous amount of footage, so they have to bring him back. Eventually, he managed to cut the film to a 248-minute runtime. He's not happy with the finished result, but it's kind of like you're saying of the essay, the student essay. It's just done.
It's done.
It's just being submitted.
Get it in.
Just get it off my desk at this point.
See if I can fluke a B or a C.
Yeah. Meanwhile, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, they initially try to go back to their partners. It doesn't work out. They divorce, and they both get married. In 1964, after all of this. They divorced 10 years later, reconciled, married for a second time a year after that.
What?
And then separated finally in 1976 for the last time.
How many hubbies did Elizabeth have?
It was 7 or 8. I forget. It was something like that. 7 or 8. I'm not sure.
Wow.
One of those
two
numbers.
What was her secret? I mean,
that's a good question. She was a very beautiful woman.
Still. And
even Colin Farrell said, he said that she was the last romantic relationship he ever had.
What?
He said,
what?
Colin Farrell?
Yeah, quote, one that was never consummated.
Right.
That is the randomest piece of tabloid trivia for you to
have 40 years
in your
senior.
Locker. Yeah.
And he was just...
It's like, yeah, Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, no, not this again. Sounds like Bertie Ahern. Oh, Lord.
Well, no, I don't actually know what he said, but he said that...
just taking a stab in the dark there when you're off. Anything to roll out that Irish lilt.
He did say that, you know...
They, love of his life.
Yeah, exactly.
Love of his life.
Google it. Trust me. I mean, it's not word for word what he said, but it's, you get the gist of it.
Massive paraphrasing. Rob's about to make up something with an Irish lilt.
Maybe they worked together once and he enjoyed her company or something. Yeah.
It does remind me of an interview that he gave. I think he did say, and I know you're Googling it now, please tell us we're on the right track, Rob, otherwise we just wasted 2 minutes.
Yeah, Colin Farrell reveals affair with Elizabeth Taylor, quote unquote. She was my last romantic relationship, he claims.
Okay, so
this was a story from 2013.
Not as Bastion or anything like that.
No, but like... He said, it was quite a, like, you know, the last, it feels like in my head, not her, I'm projecting, but the last kind of a romantic relationship I had, which was never consummated.
Why do you sound like the Irish bloke from Braveheart? Jeepers. We apologise to all the Irish out there. We know we've got one or two. How did it all end then, Sones? I mean, they married, they remarried, they divorced.
How did it all end with Colin Farrell and Elizabeth Taylor? Because I'm reading on that they met at the hospital where Farrell's youngest son, Henry, was being born. And he gets home a few days later and is thinking about Elizabeth and how she's doing.
Weird.
I mean, she must have had a magnetism
really
that, you know.
No, I mean, magnetism.
Blokes were just lining up to get married to this woman.
Yeah.
She had something. She did. As for the film, it got mixed reviews at the time. Some pretty decent ones from places like the New York Times, the LA Times, and some pretty horrendous ones as well. And in terms of how it's aged, though, I think we can all imagine. A recent comment in The Guardian describes it as a bloated and tedious, never-ending yawner that flashes briefly to life in a couple of spectacle sequences. It still managed to be the biggest U.S. movie hit of 1963, but even so, it was a financial disaster for 20th Century Fox. It more or less killed off that big budget epic that we were seeing at the time, Ben-Hur. You know, there was a trend at the time of these really large epics, and this just put an end to that. No more of that. The original budget was $2.9 million for this film. The final bill was $44
million. Jeepers.
It eventually broke even, but it took years. So, you know, in the initial 1 or 2 years, they were just millions in the red for this. Fox actually sued Liz Taylor and Richard Burton for $50 million in damages in connection with the picture. They were charged with breach of contract, with depreciating the commercial value of the movie by their scandalous conduct. And
love this little final line. 20th Century Fox were saved by what, Sonal?
The Sound of Music.
Love that.
Which came out in 1965 and it was an unexpected smash.
Wow.
I love that.
Yeah, so unexpected.
They're such a staple. I mean, they, you know, 20th Century Fox.
I know.
Yeah.
Saved by the Sound of Music.
Liz and Richard's torrid love affair almost brought them down.
Loved it. So all that. It was a cracking behind the scenes. Thoroughly enjoyed that. So I did. Fingers crossed we kept you entertained. We've informed you. We've educated you. Maybe a bit of Saturday fodder in there as well. And as Hossan is saying on the text lines, 7 husbands, 8 marriages. Of course, you married Richard twice.
The Off-Script Podcast.
This ain't fiction, we got interesting facts.
An off-script feature called Opposites Attract and it goes.
Surprising people that go way, way back.
They came together because opposites attract.
What?
That was worth waiting for.
Have we just heard? Roger and Jency are
Roger Jency will never be entering X Factor or any of the other shows of that ilk. It's fair to say.
I would quite like to see that. Maybe they'd win just purely out of their charm. You never know.
Roger's just revealed that Jency has never heard that song. She was literally going blind.
She's never heard Opposites Attract by Paula Abdul.
No.
Well, I'm impressed she managed to get it, considering.
And frankly, it shows.
Yeah. Oh, I can just imagine Raj describing it to her, and she's had to go off Raj's singing rather than the actual song.
Yeah.
Oh, bless.
Brilliant.
Okay, well, anyways, you've got a tough act to follow with that.
From this, let's talk about this. And opposites attract. We're talking about unlikely run-ins, odd couples, you could say. Okay. What does this... have to do... with this?
I've been up and down these damn hallways, in and out of these nut wards for the last 10 years. You think you could follow that act? I'm playing for my life. You working for money.
When you say you're playing for your life, am I to assume that you think that someday you're going to get out of here?
Get out of here. Get out of here. Where would I go?
That is the eerie and maniacal voice of the killer, Charles Manson.
Oh, my God.
And cult leader as well. Before the brutal murders that he was known for, he was a teenager abandoned by his parents. He was living on the streets. He spent his time mostly between prison and reform schools in much of his early life. And he'd already spent years locked away at McNeil Island Prison in Washington State. This is from 1961 to 67. And during that time in prison, he actually learned how to read music and play the guitar. I remember this fact. We're going to hear a little bit of Charles Manson's music as we go. But how does he get there from hobnobbing with celebrities? Scientology. Turns out he had a link to Scientology, and that actually managed to get him to attend several parties for movie stars when he moved over to LA after his prison release.
Why are celebrities drawn to Scientology? Just
that's
out of interest.
Good question. There must be some, because who else is drawn to Scientology other than celebrities?
Exactly.
There has
it's a
to
uniquely
be there.
Celebrity. You don't meet a bloke, you know, who works in accounts that is a secret Scientologist.
You know, that is a subject that's well worth a study, Daddy, don't you think?
Mm.
Somebody should look at that link. Maybe somebody has. Maybe we should look into if anybody has looked into that link yet.
No one else could be bothered to look into that link, but we will go there. We will really go deep into the archives.
If we get Tom Cruise, we will ask him that very question. If we ever get him in this studio. So Charles Manson moves to San Fran. He meets a 23-year-old library assistant by the name of Mary Bunner. And this is where it all starts. He moves in with her. And as he's moved in with her, he starts to attract these other women, vulnerable women, specifically teenage runaways, and just start bringing her back to live at her place. Now, of course, she didn't know she was in for all this. But it all kind of evolves. Eventually, they're all sharing Brunner's residence with 18 other women.
What?
And this is how the Manson family, as it's known, gets its start. So from there, he establishes himself something of a hippie guru. It's the summer of love. And the cult leader practices, his shady practices, are really starting to run into full force at this point. He's starting to manipulate these followers, mostly women, and getting them to submit to his will. He just seems to have some sort of hypnotic effect over all these people that he's meeting. Now, at some point, the family is a group of around 100 followers of Manson. They share this unconventional lifestyle, use of drugs, and eventually they're moving from San Fran to this deserted ranch in the San Fernando Valley. But this isn't all about Charles Manson. I just wanted to give you a little bit of an introduction for those of you that aren't familiar. I have to admit, I knew the name, but I didn't know too much about him,
I didn't.
And it was around the summer of 1968 that Dennis Wilson, brother of Brian Wilson and drummer of the Beach Boys, picks up two hitchhiking women. Now, you remember that scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dennis, before we get to what happens with those hitchhiking women, he's known for himself for a bit of a turbulent energy, a brash lifestyle. He's known as a bit of a loose cannon.
Well, he gets around.
He does get around, and he did. Trust me, he did get around.
Right.
Like Manson, though, he had a very rough childhood. Physical abuse by his father, Murray, left him with lifelong trauma. And he even identified himself as the black sheep of the Wilson family. He said, "I'm a duck who was born with two chickens." Referring, of course, to his brothers, Brian and Carl, who were in the band.
That's complimenting himself, really, isn't it? You know?
Calling yourself a duck.
Absolutely.
I think he meant like the ugly duck, you know?
Right. Ugly duckling. Yeah.
Such an odd turn of phrase, because two chickens isn't exactly...
doesn't paint them in a flattering light.
Yeah, exactly. Two chickens, brainless, squawking.
Yeah, and somehow a duck is the ferocious, ferocious one in comparison to the two chickens.
I think a duck is the glamorous one out of those three.
Yeah, maybe that's what he was saying, actually.
I've never heard that expression before or since. I think he just made it up on the spot.
Yeah, he probably did, and he was also known to be on a lot of substances, so...
Okay.
You know, that might
explain
it. He
was mixing his metaphors
there. He might have been.
He was mixing ugly duckling with something else.
Something else, exactly. The black sheep, right? He's doing exactly that. So back to those female hitchhikers. They happen to be part of the Manson family. He didn't know this, of course, but according to, and from here, the accounts of this story differ. I'm just picking one, but the end result is more or less the same. According to Diane Lake, who was a member of the family, she wasn't involved in the murders, but she did write a memoir about the whole incident. Dennis comes and drops them off. Manson invites him in, and they hit it off right away. Lake says Manson captivated Dennis Wilson, and she said it wasn't surprising. She said Charlie had skills at ingratiating himself with strangers. Dennis is in no rush to leave. He hangs out for a while. They're smoking. They're listening to a bit of Charlie's music. So Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys, and at this point, Pet Sounds has already happened. So he's a bona fide star at this point.
And he's
is
being captivated by Charles.
With Charlie Manson, yeah, as he's called. And now, within days of this first meeting, Manson and his quote-unquote family move into Wilson's home, where they just live this debaucherous lifestyle. They stay for months. They're racking up close to $1 million. If you make it in today's expenses, roughly about $1 million in expenses. They wrecked his cars. Dennis ends up trying some harder substances for the first time. And so they send him into this sprawling, massive credit card debt. They're ransacking his house. They're taking whatever they want, his clothes, his gold records, just trashing the place, basically. And initially, Dennis is speaking publicly of Manson and saying that he's happy the family are there, relieving him of the burden of wealth, like it's some sort of spiritual thing. He's definitely drank the Kool-Aid, it feels, at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting to say what happens from there, because the Beach Boys, of course, we've heard Charles Manson had a thing for music himself, thought he was something of a musician. There was actually a strange musical collaboration that happened from here. In fact, eventually Wilson broke free of the charms of Charles Manson. But before that happened, Manson was something of a musical influence. Now, we heard about how Charles Manson used to like playing the guitar. He liked to make music. This is a song that he wrote called Cease to Exist. And if you listen to the lyrics, it's really foreboding about his basic lifestyle.
Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your world. Come on, you can't be.
That is one thing that sweeper that Roger and Jency made is better than. That is better than that
well,
nonsense
I was
from
say,
Charlie Manson.
That's Dylan-esque. It's a bit more Dylan-y.
Dylan-esque.
It's a bit more Dylan-y than
it's
Beach Boys.
Yeah, definitely.
Beach Boys is kind of 60s bubblegum pop, isn't it?
Right.
Well, that's a bit more folksy. That's a bit more whimsical.
Yeah, with a bit of a cult twang.
Yeah.
You know, some creepy, creepy lyrics going on there. Anyways, it was rewritten and recorded by the Beach Boys as a song called Never Learn Not to Love. Here's the Beach Boys' take on that song.
Yeah, they've jazzed it up.
They've jazzed it up a bit. But can you believe the Beach Boys basically sang a song that was written by Charles Manson?
This
boggles the mind.
Yeah, I mean, they're an odd bunch, the Beach Boys, aren't they?
Yeah, no, they're definitely troubled, especially the brothers, especially Brian and Dennis.
But that the connection is, yeah, it's spooky, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just weird.
You would just never think that the lives of these famous musicians would ever intertwine with
one of the most notorious.
Yeah.
Yeah, individuals.
Cult leaders and killers.
Indeed. I mean, Charles Manson is... Yeah, someone not to be trifled with.
And intertwined so deeply. They lived together for months.
Well, the fact that I'm reading here as well, Soane, says it wasn't a case of Dennis Wilson saying, guys, get out. Dennis Wilson actually extricated himself from his own house.
Yeah, he eventually had enough. He got a bit spooked eventually by the whole thing. Apparently during a studio session when he had taken Charles Manson into the studio, Manson had pulled a knife on one of the producers after a disagreement. That was enough to spook Wilson, and he eventually left his own house instead of kicking them out. I mean, I suppose when you have that many people there, how are you going to deal with that? So he moved in with a buddy called Greg, and eventually, before the lease was due to run out on his apartment, all of the family members got evicted. But you just think about what he lost in the process. Yeah. He just really spiraled as well after this incident. Now, he did go on to say, you know, in an interview, as long as I live, I'll never talk about that. And he didn't live too much longer, really. He died in 1983 at the age of 39. He ended up drowning in the waters off the coast of California.
Wow, that was an accident.
Well, I don't know if it was an accident. He was in and out of rehab. He had serious substance abuse issues.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so he's really had a difficult last few years, yeah, for sure. Meanwhile, in a second odd encounter of the sorts, around the same time, also featuring Charles Manson, back in 1968. Now, this one is according to the memoir of Danny Trejo.
Yeah, actor. We're talking about him yesterday.
Yeah.
Oh, were we?
Well, yeah, I was suggesting to Chris that... for anyone who caught the Live Golf promotional materials surrounding the comeback of a certain Anthony Kim, there was something very Machete-esque about the artwork that they created
for
around
Anthony Kim.
Huh. It was this kind of grizzled, scarred kind of visage we haven't seen him for 12, 14 years, and it was like 4 or 5 decades had passed,
yeah,
to be honest. And he did look... He reminded me instantly, I thought, of the poster for Machete.
Huh? Machete. Danny Trejo.
Which is literally the only
like
film.
Say that.
And that's a man that in Danny Trejo who literally kind of wears his life on his face.
Yeah, definitely.
That's a bloke who's had some tough paper rounds.
Right, and I think it's fair to say that Anthony also wears his life on his face in that regard. They both, I believe, were sporting a ponytail as well.
But Danny came across Charles.
Well, according to his own memoir, his own autobiography, he says that when he was in an L.A. prison back in the late 60s, 1968 more specifically, once again, before the Manson family murders that are famously known actually took place, he says he meets this guy in prison, this greasy, dirty, scrawny white boy, and he actually says that he's a bit of a hypnotist. He says if that white boy wasn't a career criminal, he could have been a professional hypnotist.
Wow.
Someone who went to high schools and state fairs and got people to come on stage and act like cats and stuff. This is according to Danny Trejo. And then he goes on to reveal his actual name. He was, in fact, a career criminal. He was Charles Manson.
Jeepers.
But he says Manson would basically, with cellmates, do a kind of hypnosis to make them induce a certain state that they felt like they were in. And so allegedly, Danny Trejo and Charles Manson encountered each other in an L.A. prison
Charles
in the late
Manson,
60s.
He loved hanging out with celebs, didn't he?
Yeah, it's just
if you could call. Well, I mean, I suppose Danny was.
Yeah, we were talking about Danny Trejo. You know, we assume most of our listeners know who he is.
Yeah.
He was in a movie.
I can't recall any other movies other than Machete.
He's in Con Air.
He's in Con Air. Oh, well, there you go. Some of the biggest films in the last 40-odd years.
And as for Charles Manson, he was convicted in 1971 of first-degree murder. That was for the killings of 7 people, including the actor Sharon Tate. He was initially sentenced to death, but that was changed to life prison, and he died of natural causes in 2017.
Okay. I think a successful first edition of Opposites Attract, that. So
maybe that sweeper will be back, Chris.
Without doubt.
The Offscript Podcast.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please do go ahead and click subscribe. You can also check out our other podcasts, Time Capsule or The Big Interview. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.